Today on Against the Grain. At the height of left-wing activism in the 60s, conservatives funded tax-deductible right-wing groups on campuses to counter Black Power, demands for ethnic studies, and the New Left. As historian Lauren Shepherd illustrates, such groups like Young Americans for Freedom groomed future Republican leaders and influential conservatives like Karl Rove and Newt Gingrich, where they learned to spin unpopular politics as popular. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As the Trump administration demands obedience from universities and an end to student dissent, we look back at how in the 60s, right-wing groups operated on campuses to defend the status quo and shape young minds. I'm joined by historian of U.S. higher education, Lauren LaSab Shepherd, whose book, Resistance from the Right, Conservatives and the Campus Wars in Modern America, explores the nature of such ostensibly student-led right-wing organizing. She's the host of the weekly American Campus podcast. Lauren, what was the backdrop for conservative organizing on campuses in the late 1960s and early 1970s? What was the extent of left-wing campus protest at the time?
Not really what you think. So most an argument that I sort of start the book with is that most students in the 60s and 70s were moderate if they cared about politics at all. So just to give listeners some perspective, the total student enrollment in the fall of 1970 was about 7.4 million students, and the largest New Left Club, Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, had a peak membership of about 30,000. And most of them were members on paper, so that doesn't necessarily mean that they were active, and it definitely doesn't mean that they were militant. So in terms of, you know, how much left-wing activism was there, really not as much as we think based on the media coverage of the day and our public memory since then. I sort of argue that that's been a little overplayed, because even back then, campus organizers on the left were complaining all the time about how hard it was to get their classmates to really do anything. So the way that we sort of think about the campus of the 1960s is that it was just overflowing with hippies, which is not necessarily wrong. I mean, that was the ethos, but the hippie persona, as it were, was much more interested in dropping out of society than in, you know, doing the grassroots organizing needed to revolutionize it. And there's also been this tendency from the media of the day to conflate hippies with militant radicals. And we know that the more militant activists were much more exceptional than the rule throughout the 60s and the 70s. I mean, there was sort of a flashpoint from 1967 to 1970, which is the year that my book focuses on. But again, those years are exceptional, which is why they get a monograph. In terms of the left-wing activism that existed, there were sort of two broad camps. And those camps did have some overlap, but they were still pretty distinct, especially by race. So the first camp, a lot of what was then called Third World Alliances, so think a lot of the like anti-imperialist work, came from students and faculty on the West Coast, especially students of color. So I'm thinking Angela Davis, members of the Panthers, Red Power, Native American groups, Chicano student organizers. And of course, some of your radical members of SDS and its militant spinoffs like the Weather Underground, that's all there. But on a national scale, these groups were definitely in the minority, even though they may have played an outsized role on their own campuses. So listeners in California might be familiar with the example of San Francisco State, which was the first college to create a Black Studies program in this era. Those students were able to shut that campus down for months, but most strikes, you know, across the nation didn't sustain that sort of duration. A strike may have lasted a week or even a couple of days. So again, the sort of like memories that we have of this time are we're remembering the exceptions rather than the rule. And the second group, which is the larger group of leftists, were much less militant. They may have been radical in their thinking, but they weren't, you know, like bringing guns to campus. And these are your more Midwestern, East Coast, largely white. These are people like Jerry Rubin. On the West Coast, Tom Hayden might fit into this category. And also plenty of other white men who weren't necessarily committed left-wingers or SDSers, but they just didn't want to be drafted, right? Because this is the context of the Vietnam War. So once Nixon came into office in January of 1969, he instituted a draft lottery. And so suddenly all of these college students who had been counting on their students' deferments, those deferments didn't matter because the lottery could pick anyone. And so that caused a lot of unrest on campus. And also within Nixon's first year, he expanded our participation in the Vietnam War into Cambodia. And after that, campuses just go into this tailspin, right? That's the impetus for the Kent State Massacre, in which the Ohio National Guard shot 13 students. And then by 1971, the student deferment was ended entirely. So we see lots of mass anti-war demonstrations throughout Nixon's presidency, but after the end of the draft, campus anti-war activism just seemingly disappears, at least from the headlines. So a lot of our like radical students of color kept their convictions and kept organizing, but a lot of the white SDSers went to work on Wall Street after the Vietnam War, right? The joke is that they sort of went from yippies to yuppies. So those are sort of the two groups that students on the right really imagine themselves being embattled against.
How did, during this period, especially at its most intense, with, you know, the caveats that you just mentioned, that the kind of intensity of the protest was uneven geographically and around particular concerns, but how did campus administrators regard left-wing protesters? To what degree did they consider their protest, you know, an actual threat to the university administration, to things like funding?
Yeah, I mean, funding is really the big one. Administrators and trustees even today sort of pat themselves on the back about, you know, how much they welcome activism and free speech. But really, honestly, my sort of grand thesis in my research, not just in this book, but in projects after, is that it's the money that matters. So the Cold War context of this is really important. So this era is what's sort of remembered as the golden age of U.S. higher education, and that is because of its unprecedented enrollment, investment, and construction that takes place on campuses across the country from the end of World War II till about the end of Vietnam, right? So 1945 to 1975-ish. Before World War II, only about 1.3 million students were in college. But 30 years later, by the end of the Vietnam War, there were 8.8 million. So that's an 8-time increase in 30 years. So campuses are literally bursting at the seams. They need money to build new classrooms, dormitories, parking lots, science labs, and they get that money, right? Colleges are opening new tenured faculty lines faster than they can fill them, which is something we like can't even imagine today. So this huge enrollment boom is due to a couple of things, mostly legislation. So first, the GI Bill of 1944, and then followed by that, the Higher Education Act of 1965. So both of these pieces of legislation help working class men and women, but mostly men and mostly white men, have a way to pay for college for the first time. Now, listeners may know that Black and Native veterans had access to the GI Bill for college education, but because of very exclusionary admissions practices and some other structural barriers, Black and brown men didn't exercise their GI benefits for college at the same rate as white veterans. So again, most of this enrollment came from white men. But either way, the GI Bill effectively doubled the national population of college students, and it diversified campus not by race or gender, but by class and age, and in the case of wounded veterans, physical ability. So that's one wave. Another major factor is in 1957 when Russia launches its Sputnik satellite, which just sets off an enormous panic about a crisis in U.S. education and how we were falling behind in scientific research. So the federal government, state governments, private industries were willing to cut enormous checks to enhance U.S. STEM programs, both in higher ed and K-12, as part of this Cold War space race. On the heels of that, in 1965, the Johnson administration passes the Higher Education Act as part of the Great Society program, which allows for student loans and work-study programs. So that, again, opens the campus up to new generations of working-class students And finally, for the first time, we started to see more people of color enroll in what we call PWIs today, predominantly white institutions. So to answer your question, you know, why do trustees and administrators care? These federal grants meant that millions of dollars were on the line. Research-intensive schools like MIT, Columbia, Harvard, but in your neck of the woods, also Stanford, UC Berkeley, UCLA, they received tens of millions of dollars a semester in the 1960s for their Cold War projects. So the values of these grants in 2025 are more than eight times what they were back then. So just to give you one example, MIT received the equivalent of over $750 million today just in the fall 1968 semester. All right, so these federal military investments were hugely important. And not just for the campus, but there's a regional aspect of this too. Southern public schools like the University of Alabama was receiving tens of millions of dollars. And these grants supported the employment of hundreds of people whose pay and federal benefits were sort of unmatched compared to their other options in the private sector, especially in the South. And so in the South, where 42% of domestic military payroll was spent, and also importantly, where most young men were drafted from, anti-war dissent was like conspicuously less common on public campuses. And that's because the promise of tens and even hundreds of millions of dollars in funding helped ensure that administrators and trustees and faculty were extremely interested in war-related research. And so the idea that students would be protesting this is something that they simply would not stand for.
Trace for us, if you will, conservative activism in the lead up to the focus of your book, which is in the late 1960s, but in the 1950s, the early 60s, what motivated conservative students and how did they organize? And was it geographically uneven when you think about the U.S.?
Yeah, that the geographic question is an important one. So the big main group that I write about is called Young Americans for Freedom, or YAF, which was founded by William F. Buckley Jr. Listeners may know he goes on to be the father of the post-war conservative movement. So YAF is founded in 1960. It's founded in Sharon, Connecticut. So it definitely has this like New England sort of vibe to it. But by the end of the 1970s, it is much, much less a product of Yale and more like populist. But yeah, so we see lots of conservative activism in East Coast schools, lots in California and Arizona, the home of Barry Goldwater. Not so much in the South, which was really interesting to me as I started this project, but began to make more sense later, like we, you know, we just talked about. In the sense that conservative students are reacting to something, there was less to react to in the South. So to your question about, you know, how did this start? How did the right start organizing? The impetus for groups like YAF and some others that I write about, none of this was like a new idea. It just took on new urgency in the 1960s. So the whole idea is that the right wants its own eggheads, right? It wants its own intellectuals in on the college campus and in the classroom. So going back to the beginning of the 20th century, there were grumblings from the right and especially from Christian fundamentalists who did not like this new scientific theory of evolution. And so the thought was that the college was getting to be too secular. And then by the 1930s, American business leaders sort of joined this chorus of, you know, reactionary evangelicals, and they start producing think tanks because their concern is, you know, by the 1930s, New Deal projects are starting to pick up. They don't like all of this Keynesianism that's emanating from the ivory tower. Franklin Roosevelt's brain trust, right, was this cadre of academics. So these industrialists want to set up their own think tanks that will sort of challenge the anti-capitalist stuff that's coming out of the college. And of course, they set these think tanks up as nonprofits so that the benefactors themselves can write large checks, right? They can grant these gifts and then they would be tax deductible. But to me, this is also ironic because historians kind of agree that Roosevelt's New Deal was an effort to actually save capitalism from itself, not destroy it. So that just sort of, like, to me, it just highlights how histrionic some of these people were. But yeah, so some of the big funders, the William Volcker Fund, the John M. Olin Fund, some listeners may be familiar with today, like the Bradley Foundation, the Koch Foundations, the SCAFE Foundations. Those were all in the mix going back, you know, really early. Some of them don't come around until after the 60s, but some earlier ones have been there since the 1930s. So this idea from the right that the college had become too secular, too socialist, we might think today is like ridiculous. But their idea was that they wanted to balance what students were supposedly learning. So their nonprofits included another group I write a lot about, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI, but also the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, the Institute of Humane Studies, IHS. All of these, by the way, still exist today, and they're still active, and they will still give you money for your right-wing projects if you're interested. But essentially, they pass out free books, magazines, pamphlets, lots of media, again, as a corrective to what they thought students were learning in the classroom. And ISI, importantly, set up fellowships so that they could sort of identify conservative students and then pay them to go to grad school, right? So that the notion is that we're going to guarantee this steady stream of future right-wingers in the academy. So if listeners are familiar with like the Federalist Society, for example, the ways that that organization works to get conservatives through law school with a particular legal training, ISI is the equivalent of that for the academy in terms of identifying and training future professors.
Historian Lauren Shepherd is my guest. We're discussing her book, Resistance from the Right, Conservatives and the Campus Wars in Modern America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you mentioned Young Americans for Freedom, which was a crucial organization of the campus right, started in 1960. Can you tell us how it came into being and what role it played in positioning conservative views in a time where so many of these ideas were not enormously popular, or at least as popular as these people would want them to be? How did a group like Young Americans for Freedom start, and how did it place itself in relation to the broader attitudes of people on campus?
Yeah, an argument that I make in the book is that many of these groups were astroturfed. And what I mean by that is they weren't necessarily grassroots, self-organized by the students who would eventually become members. So they were astroturfed in the sense that there are older conservatives, people like age 35 and older, people like William F. Buckley Jr., who have lots of time and lots of experience, and they're willing to serve as mentors to sort of organize these college and community groups too, because YAF was also based. They had local organizations, county organizations, and state organizations. But the idea that this was going to be that these are youth groups. So YAF comes about in 1960. Buckley founds it before YAF. ISI had existed since about 1953. But ISI was sort of the intellectual wing of students on the right. YAF was supposed to be the activist group. And then, of course, there were college Republicans who were like the political organization. Although in the 1960s, the Republican Party hadn't quite sorted itself ideologically yet. Neither of the parties had, I should say. And so there were still plenty of liberals in college Republicans. So they weren't always invested in right wing projects, although some chapters definitely were. So, yeah, YAF is sort of the central group. And one of its strategies, this is something that it learned from its mentors who would give these students handbooks. You know, here's what to do. Here's how to organize. Here's how to start your campus newspaper, or alternative newspaper, as they called it, borrowing that from the left. They encouraged the students to create new auxiliary clubs, give them new names, and pretend like they're separate organizations from YAF. So one campus, for example, may have a chapter of ISI, of YAF, also of Students Against Communism, Students for Reagan for President in 1968, right? And if you looked at the rosters, they're all the same students. So that's just a strategy to make conservatism sort of artificially appear more widespread than it was on the campus. These students were obsessed with their image. They were obsessed with membership numbers. They often would take credit for events that weren't even theirs. But if, you know, if they brought two students to, let's say the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, were holding an anti-war rally, a handful of Yaffers might show up and then claim that they had, you know, this major counter protest. They would write their own press releases. They wanted to make sure that their organizational names were in the campus papers all the time. So your question earlier, you know, what sort of role did YAF play in all of this? So some of the organizations on the right, I mentioned YAF was the activist group. ISI was the intellectual group. College Republicans was the political. There's also Campus Crusade for Christ, which was like the evangelical arm. By the end of the 1960s, each of these groups had become to some degree beholden to YAF, because YAF was the loudest, it was the best at organizing, it had the most money because it was taking donations from conservative ideologues and local business people. And so what bound these groups together through the Vietnam War and the civil rights era, they claimed was anti-communism. But what they were actually responding to was just liberalism, right? We didn't have a real communist movement in the United States in the 1960s. And that's become totally transparent today, now that the Cold War is over and there is no, you know, supposed threat of communism. The right is just more transparent that what they don't like is liberalism. So I make an argument in the book that as historians, we would do well to reconsider our understanding of anti-communism as the glue that binds these different multiple strands of conservatism, like libertarianism and evangelicalism, because we know that for the new right, which is what these students were calling themselves, anti-communism was just a euphemism. Rather, it's resistance to liberalism that animated the various factions, as it continues to, right? So we sort of have been uncritically accepting the right's coded framing when we should really just state what they meant when they said anti-communism. It meant they are wholesale rebuking pluralism.
You mentioned, Lauren, that these organizations were astroturfed organizations in that they were started by funders, organizers, people on the right who then helped foster the development of these organizations on campus. And you also talked about the kind of conundrum that they faced, these groups, because they chose to try and make their politics seem more popular than they in fact were. How did they make an alliance with people in positions of authority beyond those who might start these organizations? How do they relate, for example, to university administrations?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So these students sort of just intuit power. I mean, you have to think, these are some of the earliest baby boomers, right? These are people who were born in the immediate post-war era. Sort of the historical understanding of this era was it was a time of lots of conformity. And so this is not something, I mean, of course the students are, as I argue, mentored. But again, I think that isn't to say that there's not some inherent like conservatism within them. What they're being mentored, the lessons that they're learning is how to organize. It's not that they're necessarily being indoctrinated by these beliefs. Those beliefs I do think were organic themselves. But I show throughout the book that the students form alliances with powerful figures in the larger conservative movement and also corporate sponsors. And the idea is that not only will they get financial support, but they also get the assurance of legal, physical, and carceral punishment against their adversaries. So the whole second part of the book is about students trying to punish left-wingers and what they have to do in order to make that happen. So, you know, I write about students at Columbia in 1968 is the example I use, but there are lots of others. There's a big movement in California, actually, of students wearing blue buttons. It was sort of a way to identify themselves on campus as a conservative. And it set them apart from the anti-war students who were often wearing like black armbands or dressing in certain ways that made them look like hippies, right? The conservative students are really putting on this outward show that they are trads, they're squares, they're wearing their blue buttons, they support the police, they support the administrator, their college presidents and their trustees. they would cheer on administrators and trustees who took really hard line stances. So a good example of this is S.I. Hayakawa at San Francisco State University. And most of these endorsements were enacted really theatrically, right, through excessive shows of approval. Another example that I really like, at Cleary College in Michigan, 500 students, or, you know, they claimed, again, it's hard to trust these numbers, but Yaff writes that they had 500 students holding a pro-administration rally in which the student government presented a portrait to the university president, like as a gesture of appreciation because he had been so tough on student protesters. Students at the University of Nevada did the same thing. They showered their president and his wife with like applause. They had an Ed Miller Day. They had a 24-gun salute from the ROTC squadron. I think they even gave his wife like jewelry or something, and a paid weekend vacation, like just really over the top stuff. I mean, the flattery to power, is sort of a through line that you can really see in the primary sources here. Another thing students would often do, is if they're supporting administrators and trustees who would crack down against left-wing organizing. But if they couldn't count on their administrators to do that, they would try to punish the administrators themselves. So they would like harass their college presidents. They would flood the office with telegrams saying, you know, you really need to expel these students. And expulsion is something that students on the right really like called for all the time, because as we know, in the context of the Vietnam War, if a student is expelled, they automatically lose their draft deferment. This is, of course, before all of the changes to the draft brought by Nixon. But I mean, that was something that they called for all the time.
Historian of U.S. higher education, Lauren Shepherd, is my guest. She is the author of Resistance from the Right, Conservatives and the Campus Wars in Modern America. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, Lauren, you mentioned a few minutes ago, Columbia, 1968. And I wonder if you can remind us briefly of what was taking place on campus in 1968 and why those protests alarmed the right and galvanized it.
Yes. So Columbia, in April and May of 1968, gets its own chapter in the book. For listeners who are not familiar, this situation sort of starts off with two parallel protests. So on one end, you have mostly white SDS students who are protesting the university's affiliation with war research. And the second parallel protest is a group of mostly black students from the Afro-American Society organizing against the administration because it's encroaching even further into the Harlem neighborhood. It was also trying to build a gym, and the gym was supposed to be community access, right? So remember, Columbia is a private college, it's a private institution, but it was going to allow people who lived in nearby Harlem access to the gym. However, because the gym was going to be physically constructed on a hill up in the air, looking down over Harlem residents, the entry point for Harlem residents was going to be on a lower back floor, like not the main entrance. So the Afro-American Society was organizing that the gym in its physical construction was racist. And also, you know, it's going into the community. It's buying up property that should have been parks and should have been green spaces for the people who live there. This is actually, by the way, I want to note, a very common story of colleges expanding into neighborhoods where they're not wanted. So anyway, we have these two parallel protests happening. Students on the right, students who are part of Young Americans for Freedom and their other front organizations, sort of argued that this was all one movement when it definitely wasn't, right? SDS and the Afro-American Society actually had major conflicts with each other. And if you get into the records, this all becomes very clear, but that didn't matter for students on the right. All they see is that there's protests on campus, there's a strike, there's building occupations, students are being disrespectful to the authority of the administrators and the purpose of the school in conducting its war research. So, this situation is important because I argue in the book For the first few years of the Rights Campus organizing, they were really disjointed. There was so much infighting and bickering, especially between libertarians and traditionalists. And what happened at Columbia was galvanizing for the right, because they realized if they could just set aside all their differences and agree to be in a mutual solidarity against the left, so against the white SDSers and the Black Students and Afro American Society, they can call themselves a majority coalition. Now, I want to be very clear. The majority coalition at Columbia is not what ended the strikes at all, but it didn't really matter to students on the right. It was a new technique that they thought sort of worked. And so they adopt the majority coalition for all of the semesters following the spring of 1968. So throughout that summer, YAF is creating organizational manuals. It's holding summer conferences and workshops to train its students to create these majority coalitions all across the country. And so the thing about the majority coalition is it doesn't, like, that's the title, it doesn't carry the baggage of Young Americans for Freedom, which at that point, you know, students could identify with the right. It was supposedly this neutral terminology. Again, it's representing or claiming to represent a majority. Lots of liberals joined these organizations for different reasons. Sometimes it was just that, you know, students were engineering majors. And when, I don't know, IBM came to campus to recruit, they didn't want the recruiters to be harassed by anti-war protesters because, you know, they wanted a job. So those students would join a majority coalition. So it was a pretty effective way for the right to build solidarities across groups that they would otherwise be continually bickering with.
In the late 60s, in the early 70s, there were, not just at Columbia, extensive organizational efforts for ethnic studies and Black studies programs on campus. Can you tell us about how the campus right mobilized to pose these using language that in some ways I think echoes strongly in our day of positioning white students as victims?
Yeah, I mean, students on the right were pretty straightforward in their racism if you look back in the primary sources. At the University of Georgia, their campus conservative club wrote literally, and this is a quote, about the racial inferiority of Blacks, and they warned against the repression of conservative students as administrators sided with, quote, hip degenerates against normal people. You know, that's explicitly clear that they're positioning people who are not white as not normal. Young Americans for Freedom, their national magazine, The New Guard, produced so many articles that had the N-word. At Stanford, for example, there's an article that talks about using the N-word. It says, you know, the N-word at Stanford are no longer Black students, they're conservatives. The administration doesn't give a damn about the students. They don't care about moderates or conservatives on campus because they know that we're not going to sit in the old union or try to burn down a building. You think having Black skin is some kind of a drawback here? Try wearing a Nixon button to class. That is all a quote from an article in the New Guard. I mean, they often talked about how white students were victims of reverse oppression. They compared student organizers in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to the Klan. They referred to Muhammad Ali, the boxer, as a clown, as a front man for vicious Black supremacist groups, worse than the KKK. I mean, really just, I don't even have to describe this. Listeners hear what I'm saying. It's absolutely awful. And another episode that I write about, just because this is quite close to home for me in Louisiana, conservatives often would just terrorize Black and Jewish students by saying that they would put them to death. So at LSU, David Duke, who at one point ran for president as a Republican, but in 1970, he wasn't at LSU. He was on the Tulane campus in New Orleans. And he appeared wearing a Nazi stormtrooper uniform. He had a swastika on his left arm. Yeah, he's hoisting a sign that says, "Gas the Chicago 7," which is a reference to New Left demonstrators, many of whom were Jewish, who were at that point awaiting trial because they had disrupted the 1968 DNC. And so that's one side of the poster. On the other side, the poster says Kunstler, referring to the group's lawyer, William Kunstler, says Kunstler is a communist Jew. I mean, really, like, truly just so bold and so out in their racism. And it's important to remember that students like Duke got, which actually, I should clarify, David Duke had dropped out of college at that point. In 1970, he was just on campus being a menace, not as a student. But David Duke had no trouble in doing something like this, right? In wearing a swastika uniform, or a Nazi stormtrooper uniform to campus with a swastika, holding up signs. That was not a problem, right? That's speech that would have been protected. No, not would have been, that sounds conditional. It was protected. Whereas, let's say students who were a member of the Black Student Union often were harassed, had stuff thrown at them. The administration was trying to come up with all sorts of different reasons to stop their speech. So it's really, it's always interesting to me, even in the present, when we hear like campus free speech debates, it's almost always used to protect the free speech of people with the most awful things to say.
How are lawsuits used by campus right-wing students against the left? You know, you talked about how the right on campus would push to expel student protesters, but tell us about their use of lawsuits, including when students went on strike after the invasion of Cambodia and the killing of students at Kent State.
Yes, so the lawsuits really come about after the Columbia situation. So in May of 1968, a group of conservative students at Columbia in nearby areas, like other campuses in New York, were upset that the strike had shut down campus. And so they, in their majority coalition, filed a lawsuit against their administrators. Again, I said a second ago, you know, students were often encouraging of administrators who used harsh punishments, but when they couldn't rely on their college presidents or trustees to do that, they would attack the trustees and the president. So this majority coalition lawsuit argued that the students had already paid their tuition for the semester, and because of the strike, they weren't able to attend class. And so they were trying to sue the institution to force it to remain open. And so that's the first of these majority coalition lawsuits. But we see them all over the place. The University of Southern California was sued, Wisconsin, Adelphi, George Washington, dozens of other places. Most of these were in the East Coast. And it's interesting because the suits were often filed by YAF mentors, right? So some of the attorneys who would have been, you know, on the board of the YAF national organization, or they were YAF veterans themselves. And very few of these lawsuits were actually successful. But just the threat that, you know, if you are on the board of trustees, or if you are a college president, the threat that you're going to be sued was enough to sort of inspire you to crack down on some of these protests. So again, the one at Columbia in 68 was the first, but to the question that you're asking about, in 1970 after Kent State, almost half of all colleges in the U.S. shut down the last week or so of May in 1970, because again, Ohio National Guard shot 13 students on campus. And then 2 weeks later in Jackson, Mississippi, Mississippi local police in Jackson shot additional students, killed two others. And so there were just nationwide strikes over these two events. And I should be clear, the events following Kent State, those were the most extreme strikes. White students didn't seem to care too much about what happened in Jackson. But there were local protests against that. Anyway, my point is that about half of all college campuses shut down. So this is like catnip for YAF, right? This is the perfect sort of setup or test that they could use to try to force these injunctions on campuses to stay open. And like I said a second ago, most of the time they weren't successful, but it didn't matter. The threat was sort of the point.
So what lessons did right-wing students in the late 60s, early 70s draw from their time as minority figures on campuses while left-wing protest was taking place? What lessons did they draw that influenced their outlook as future leaders of the new right, of the Republican Party, and what leaders were shaped by this campus activism?
So again, this is the generation that calls itself the new right, and that is a play on the new left of the 1960s. Another thing that I argue in the book is that a lot of the right's sort of slogans and even their actual tactics, they're just co-opting from what they see the left do, and they're repurposing it for their own missions. But yeah, this generation of the new right, they graduate in the 70s. And by 1990s, this is like the Newt Gingrich class of conservatives that end up taking over Congress. Newt Gingrich, in fact, was a Young Americans for Freedom member who organized a massive counter protest in support of the tragedy at Kent State, like arguing that, well, you know, that's what happens. You protest, you get shot by the National Guard. There's incredible video footage of Newt Gingrich at Tulane in 1970, if any listeners are interested. But yes, a lot of these veterans of the campus wars in the 1960s went on to work in the Nixon White House. They worked for Reagan. Reagan was campaigning for president as early as 1968. And so many of those students were championing him, you know, over a decade before he actually does become president. They worked in both Bush administrations. Someone I write a lot about is David Keene, who goes on to be the president of the NRA. YAF and ISI alumni are former Vice President Dan Quayle, their Supreme Court Justices Neil Gorsuch and Sam Alito, dozens of members of Congress and federal judges. Some of the right's biggest ghouls are David Duke, who I mentioned earlier, but also Stephen Miller, Mark Thiessen, Peter Thiel, David Sachs, Ann Coulter is an ISI alum. Attorney General Bill Barr was at Columbia in 1968. He was one of the majority coalition students. Another Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, also a college Republican alum, Karl Rove, the conservative strategist, Ross Douthat at the New York Times and the Atlantic is an alum of ISI. I mean, these people are everywhere. And it's not like a secret part of their past. It's easy to figure out if you just go to today. YAF is not Young Americans for Freedom anymore. It's called Young Americans Foundation, but it's still the same organization. If you go to YAF or ISI's website, I mean, you can see all their alum, because again, they're very proud of these people and the positions of power that they've occupied, you know, for the last 60 years.
Historian Lauren Shepherd joins me on Against the Grain. She's the author of Resistance from the Right, Conservatives and the Campus Wars in Modern America. I'm Sasha Lilly. So Lauren, taking things then to the present, with in recent years widespread protests on university campuses against both the U.S. government and university complicity in supporting the Israeli assault on Gaza. You know, we've seen again right-wing campus groups calling for punishment of left-wing activists, and we've even seen violent attacks on student protesters, such as at UCLA. What parallels and, you know, also differences do you see between the right and universities in the 1960s and today?
Well, I'll start with the differences. So one of the biggest differences that I see, even though I just spent all of this time arguing that there wasn't that much militancy in the 1960s, I think that even by 1960 standards, our students today have not been as militant. Our students are not blowing up buildings. They are not setting fire to ROTC centers. They are not barricading military recruiters on their campus. Those things are some pretty obvious differences. But I should also say here, the context matters too, because in the 1960s, American students themselves were being drafted, or American young men were being drafted to fight in the war in Vietnam, or at least in U.S. participation in Vietnam's civil war. That's not necessarily the case today. What students are protesting is their university's complicity in that war, and they're protesting American taxpayers' money, you know, going to fund bombs and all of the weapons that Israel is using in Palestine and in Gaza. So that's one sort of contextual difference. But I mean, otherwise, I see lots of parallels, right? This works very much in the same way. Power does not want to be challenged. What we've seen today is that trustees and college administrators are pretty willingly capitulating to the Trump administration. Harvard has stood up, and of course, we should applaud that, but we should also recognize that Harvard is the institution best in the position to do that, right? They have a $55 billion endowment. Columbia, similarly positioned with its multi-billion dollar endowment, has just completely caved. So, you know, and Harvard and Columbia tend to dominate the headlines on this front, but we all know that these policies have affected every single one of our institutions, big and small, private and public, those with multi-billion dollar endowments, and those that are in the hole. So all of our schools sort of have targets on their back, and I should say, so do our colleagues in K-12 as well. I think anyone who has studied this knows that anticipatory obedience will only prolong these attacks against higher education, that caving in the way that Columbia has, that going along with what this administration is asking of places like Columbia. I mean, Columbia can withstand this. Some of our smaller institutions cannot. And Columbia, Harvard, Penn, the others are setting the tone for what the rest of us will face.
What about the right on campuses? Because obviously university administrators are playing a particular role. But do you see parallels between campus groups on the right now and then in terms of the role that they are playing?
This isn't to say they don't exist. There are chapters of Young Americans for Freedom, Young America's Foundation today. There's also, you know, Turning Point USA. A lot of those are astroturfed as well, right? They're sponsored by the Charlie Kirks of the world. So again, people over 30 who are trying to identify and recruit conservative students. A lot of the resistance that we've seen from the right has come from fraternities. So I'm thinking the spring of 2024 at the University of Mississippi or Ole Miss, sorority brothers who were sort of standing up against students who were protesting for Gaza. I mean, most of the resistance has come from outside law firms. It's come from organizations like Stop Antisemitism Now. And I'll just reiterate that point. I mean, it is the older generation. The pushback is not necessarily coming from undergraduates or graduate students. It's these, again, more astroturfed groups. One that immediately comes to mind is Faculty Against Antisemitism Movement. And a lot of these, of course, you know, many of them are led by Jewish leaders. These are people who would say that they have a Zionist approach to Israel and to Gaza and Palestine, obviously. But these groups are sort of presenting themselves as speaking for all of Jewish people. And I don't think the media does much to cover Jewish groups who are anti-Zionist or who are speaking up, like Jewish Voice for Peace is one example. They're doing a lot of work and they don't tend to get the press that some of the very Zionist organizations are getting.
Lauren Shepherd, I wonder if I could end by asking you a more historic question, which is, and something you've written about recently, which is that, as you've just been discussing, obviously, universities are under attack by the Trump administration, and members of academia and the broader public have called on administrators to stand up for their students around Palestine, Gaza, around the right to dissent, you know, not passing on the names of students. Why do you think we shouldn't be surprised, looking historically, when those administrators don't act to protect their students?
The themes that I see when administrators are being faced with the wrath of U.S. larger politics, when they crack down on their students, it's typically around two issues. It's around racial discrimination and around war. And so for the past century, I mean, truly for over 100 years, administrators have tended to side with vengeful politicians because they're more concerned about their reputations than they are about students' academic freedom or their First Amendment rights or even their safety. And then the second reason, which we definitely saw and we've been discussing, is the university's outsized role in the Cold War. And that's the money, right? The strings attached. When it comes to their bottom lines, U.S. colleges, they want to be financially secure. And, you know, we can talk about reasons why they aren't. I mean, you know, again, Columbia and Harvard and the University of Texas with their multi-billion dollar endowments, that's exceptional. Most schools sort of struggle to forecast, you know, what will enrollment be next year? What will alumni donations look like? What will state appropriations look like? Will we get these grants from our industry partners? Will we get, obviously, will we get federal money? That's a question, major question that's on the line right now. So administrators and their financial advisors are motivated to sort of shelter their cash. And so appeasing forms of power or appeasing the Trump administration right now is definitely a way that administrators think that they can, you know, safeguard their bottom lines. I think that that is naive. What institutions tend to do, something that they have done since campus wars of the 1960s, actually, is take a position of institutional neutrality. And this got started at the University of Chicago in 1967 with their Calvin Report. That's sort of the model for university policies today. But what that report says is that, above all, the university is a corporation, and its first duty is to protect its financial interests. And so it adopts a stance of neutrality. And that is meant to be, you know, you could be cynical about this and say, well, that's just a cop-out. Really, it's not a cop-out. It's actually, it actually is taking a side, right? Even though it's this strategic sort of verbal appeal to fairness, in practice, neutrality just upholds the status quo, right? So, which is the exact conditions that your students are protesting against. So I've argued before that institutional neutrality is just this clever rhetorical sleight of hand to, you know, keep power exactly where it is.
Lauren Shepherd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to have this discussion.
Lauren Lesab Shepherd is a historian of U.S. higher education, author of Resistance from the Right, Conservatives and the Campus Wars in Modern America. She's host of the weekly American Campus podcast. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.